in France. Robert Del Grande, trained as a biochemist, followed a similar MO at Houston's Café Annie. This community followed a staggered, slightly altered version of the path forged by their predecessors in New York, California, and Louisiana. They revered food writers, only instead of the French explorations of Olney and David, they obsessed over Diana Kennedy's Mexican cookbooks and the writings of Patricia Quintana. And in place of Michael McCarty, they had Anne Lindsay Greer, who was consulting to the Lowe's Anatoly Hotel in the early 1980s, and named the emerging style Southwestern. She also arranged for guest chefs such as Forgione, Ogden, and Puck to visit the hotel to cook wine dinners, giving the Texas chefs a prize chance to meet them. In August 1984, Greer organized a gathering to bring this emerging group together. Known today as the potluck, they gathered together, each showing off their own dishes, talking over ingredients, techniques, and inspirations. Greer understood the value of press and invited Michael Bauer, then editor of the gourmet section of the Dallas Times-Herald, who was the first to write about the movement, comparing it to the California School. In 1984 and 85, the Great Chefs television series aired a 26-part arc called Great Chefs of the West. In April 1986, many of the chefs began cooking for the Hill Country Festival in Austin and were being welcomed into the national fold at Puck and Lazaroff's Meals on Wheels benefit in Los Angeles and the City Meals on Wheels summer fundraiser in New York City. Miller would open his own seminal Southwestern restaurant, Coyote Cafe, in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in 1987, following it in 1991 with Red Sage in Washington, D.C. Another sign of increased cross-pollination? Back in New York City, with Bud's slated for a September opening, Master and Waxman, who brought California cuisine to town, struck a deal for Paul Prudhomme to make the space his home for the summer, importing his K. Paul Roadshow and New Orleans food to New York, as he'd done 2 years prior in San Francisco. Pop-up wasn't yet in the vernacular. The participants referred to the residency as an instant restaurant. Prudhomme kicked off the 5-week stint with a party, then, because a city official who had attended the opening observed exposed wires, flies, improper meat storage and oven ventilation, and no operating permit, the health department ordered a shutdown. Waxman claimed to the New York Times that his team had reached out to the mayor's office. "We'll see who's more powerful," said an increasingly cocky Waxman. "The mayor or his health commissioner?" With notices posted on the door, 250 people queued up along Columbus Avenue, drinking beer and wine in anticipation of blackened redfish, Cajun jambalaya, shrimp remoulade, sweet potato pecan pie, and bread pudding. The city official who ratted out Waxman and Master also observed unfinished floors at Bud's. One former waiter remembers those floors, considered them a sign of burgeoning hubris. "They opened it without a floor, just cement. It was kind of an important time where I think they thought they could do anything. Melvin and Jonathan, they thought their shit was just gold. Every day we'd go into work, we'd have to move the tiles that hadn't been set to a different area, and then bring it back in so the tile setters could set it the next day." Regardless, Bud scored, earning a 2-star review in the New York Times. Brian Miller contrasted the simplicity and freshness with the Upper West Side's quiche belt, commenting that it's no wonder the locals are rushing to Bud's like surfers to 10-foot swells. One of the cooks in the kitchen at Bud's was a young, carrot-topped Bobby Flay, a self-described knock-around kid and corner boy from the Upper East Side who had dropped out of high school, discovered the kitchen around 1981 when his father got him a job at the theater district mainstay Joe Allen. Flay had always been attracted to cooking. Early memories focus on the alchemy of the kitchen, making deviled eggs, or stirring mighty fine pudding mix until it thickened. Flay wasn't attuned to the uptick in American cuisine, didn't read the Times or New York Magazine, wasn't privy to the Revolution, hadn't heard of Forgione or wine or the Waltucks, let alone anything happening out west. But 6 months into his time at Joe Allen, he woke up one morning, stared up at the ceiling, and thought to himself, "I cannot wait to go to work today." I'd never felt that before. Flay's first inkling of the possibilities of the profession came when managers returned from Joe Allen's Los Angeles outpost with menus from Spago in hand. To me, Wolfgang had it all. He was a great chef, and he had the environment. He had Hollywood. What do they do in Hollywood? They make people stars. That was the first time I had heard of somebody being known for their cooking in this other way, in this star way. That might sound trivial at this point, but we really didn't know the name of the chefs in the restaurants. That was the first time I became aware of it. In 1984, Joe Allen himself ponied up the $6,800 tuition for Flay to attend a new culinary school based in New York City, the French Culinary Institute. Flay was one of nine inaugural students at the Soho-based school, still under construction when he started. He was the youngest by 5 or 6 years, and one of the few people that wasn't on a second career or recovering from divorce. The AIDS epidemic was in full force and claimed about a third of his class within a few years, along with many of his co-workers from Joe Allen. People would get a cough and be in the hospital. Be dead in 6 weeks, he remembers. After the six-month program, Flay took a job as sous chef at Brighton Grill, a new Upper East Side restaurant by a first-time restaurateur, socialite Stephanie Guest. The chef, says Flay, had a multitude of issues. He would sleep on the dirty laundry in the restaurant all night. He liked tequila, and a lot of it. That lasted a week. I was standing there, so was promoted to chef. I just used my ability from hanging out in the streets to fucking get it done. But I was completely overwhelmed, insecure. I wouldn't hire people who were too good or better than me because I'd be exposed. I was insane. I'd go to the Fulton Fish Market every morning. I got the restaurant under control, and we had good business, but after a year I could not stand up. I said, I cannot do this anymore. The next job he landed was at Bud's. I walked into this kitchen. I didn't know this world existed, says Flay. If there were 10 cooks there, everybody was Michael Jordan. One person after another was a fucking amazing cook. Jonathan wasn't in the kitchen a lot, so we all sort of learned from each other. Flay lacked expertise, but was faster than anybody, made himself invaluable by helping the kitchen keep pace with a never-ending rush of orders. Fire up the grill wasn't turning some buttons. We had mesquite wood. We made beurre blanc in every color of the rainbow, blood orange, chive. It was butter and cream sauces, and vinaigrettes that were sauces as well. Lots of relishes and sauces, because it was a Southwestern restaurant. I remember watching this girl taking corn off the cob and thinking, that's how it's done. Flay was taken with the Southwestern palate of the restaurant, and on several levels. He found it shrewd because it dovetailed with the American love for bastardized Mexican food and the attendant tequila, a surefire revenue generator, at its apex in 1980s New York City. And he found the ingredients exotic. Blue corn didn't come as a tortilla chip in a bag. We had blue cornmeal. We had all these fresh and dried chilies, all these different beans. These things had never come to the East Coast in this form before. Never. As Massachusetts native Mark Miller had before him, Flay, who had found his career on the style, gravitated to Southwestern flavors, even though he came from the East Coast. When I think about it, those flavors meld very well with my personality. My first cookbook was Bold American Food. It meant not only the ingredients, but also an approach. Those ingredients at that point in my life made perfect sense for me. I needed ingredients with attitude. I was seduced by the idea. Went from Brighton Grill, a neighborhood restaurant, just feeding people, to this other world I didn't know existed. Like so many fellow cooks at the time, Flay was fully immersed in food. Waxman and Master opened a third restaurant, Hewlett's, in summer 1986, and Flay and other cooks, many of whom bounced around among the growing Empire's restaurants, would go in on Sunday, when it was closed, and work on slow cooking preparations. Most intoxicatingly, the burgeoning American Chef Society was literally paraded in front of Flay at Bud's. Our kitchen was open. You'd go downstairs, off the dining room, like 3 or 4 steps. You had to go through there to get to the bathroom. So I'd be cooking, and all of a sudden, Mark Miller would be eating my mise en place, or Wolfgang Puck would come in. During the City Meals on Wheels week, they were all here. Dean Fearing, Stephen Piles, and Alice Waters. I was like, what the fuck is going on here? This is like Disney World. Now I know who they are. I'm paying attention to food. I'm like, these are the American gods of food, and they're eating my corn relish off my mise en place. And that's the power of Jonathan. He's part of this situation. The Southwestern presence and the California influx in New York City deepened at the hands of Clark Wolf, who had found his way to Manhattan and was functioning as a consultant to Sign of the Dove owner Joseph Santo. Wolf recruited Brendan Walsh back from San Francisco. He also enlisted Judy Rogers, a Chez Panisse alumna who would go on to take over the kitchen at San Francisco's Zuni Cafe and turn it into a classic, as consulting chef at Yellow Fingers in the same building. Walsh says he picked up a little bit of that anti-structure, the change in the French model of the kitchen, from San Francisco. When I came back to do Arizona 206, everybody's involved in the menu, collaborative. I had 50% women, 50% men. Because of that environment, I think that's why the food was so much fun. New York City had become a magnet, and not just for Americans. Brother and sister Gilbert and Magoy Lacoz imported their fashionable, cutting-edge fish temple, Le Bernardin, from Paris, opening on West 51st Street in 1986. That same year, Jean-Georges Vongerichten, an alum of the kitchens of Paul Iberlin, Bocuse, and Autier, came to Lafayette in Swiss hotel The Drake, bringing with him a distinct marriage of French finesse and Asian influence, picked up in stints in Thailand, Singapore, and Hong Kong. Though French, these chefs were definitely of a new guard, both on the plate and in their attitude toward Americans. Years later, Vongerichten would enshrine Barry Wine's pizza on his menu at Mercer Kitchen. The general public was becoming interested. These years saw an uptick in media coverage and business opportunities for chefs in the United States. Profiles and lifestyle features proliferated in local and national newspapers and magazines, and more powerfully on television, where the ability to perform a cooking demonstration choreographed for studio cameras and timed to meet a producer's specs became a requirement for any self-respecting chef, many of whom began enlisting media trainers. An early and prestigious television series was PBS's Great Chefs, which debuted in 1982, and focused on the chefs of particular cities, countries, and regions. There was a confluence of two circumstances, says David Kratz, who launched a successful chef and restaurant public relations firm in New York City, starting in the mid-1980s, when such a specialization was novel, and signed the Gotham Bar and Grill as a client immediately after Portale was hired to be the chef. One was this American cuisine explosion. The other was a media explosion. It was right at the time when cable TV was just coming online. There weren't thousands of channels. That was a big wave. All of a sudden, there became a need for people who were really professional at understanding media outlets and the difference between them and what they would be interested in and how to navigate them and how to talk to different ones. Chefs started to become interesting in other ways because these guys were young and attractive and well-spoken and standard bearers for a new type of style. New Yorkers had started generally to become proud of the fact that there were these good restaurants. They were New York restaurants, and they were American. New York had always had famous old restaurants, but even then you probably wouldn't have known who the chefs were particularly. They were just as famous as these fancy restaurants. Other types of media also started to become interested, because culturally it was shifting, and the general public was becoming interested. In another shift, the industry began giving itself awards, staging events that combined the pomp and grandeur of the Stanford Court dinner and charity tasting events with the aggrandizement of the Food and Wine Honor Roll of American Chefs and the Great Chefs television series. In 1984, Cooks Magazine introduced its Who's Who in American Cooking, which became an annual happening in New York City. Hollywood has its Oscars. The television profession gives Emmys. Now the food world in this country has begun to honor its producers, chefs, vintners, writers, and restaurateurs, wrote Margaret Engel in the Washington Post in 1985. Last year, everyone was talking about new American cooking, said Cooks Magazine's Christopher Kimball, on the occasion of the second annual awards, held at the cavernous Palladium nightclub in downtown Manhattan. Now the awareness has grown that it's not just a trend, and people simply refer to it as American cooking. It's taken this country a long time to recognize its roots, but now that it has, the cuisine is flourishing. The second annual Who's Who Awards were held in October 1985. James Beard had died earlier that year, and the James Beard Award for Special Achievement was introduced. It went to Alice Waters. The award spoke to the still relative paucity of noteworthy chefs around the country, as the number of honorees was reduced from 50 in 1984 to 25. That same year, Harper and Row published Ellen Brown's book, Cooking with the New American Chefs, the latest attempt to corral and chronicle the emerging chef community from across the country. Brown's book includes non-Americans like Wolfgang Puck and the legendary Jean-Louis Payadon, a native of Condom in France's Gascony region, who had come from two Michelin star success in France to open Jean-Louis at the Watergate in Washington, D.C. in 1979, and became a heroic figure to many East Coast chefs for his larger-than-life personality, mad natural talent, willingness to hire Americans, and tireless efforts to help establish a network of sources by deepening the relationship between chefs and farmers and purveyors. He also embraced traditionally American ingredients like corn and crawfish and eschewed the term nouvelle cuisine in favor of the more approachable free cooking. For me, he was one of the most inspiring chefs that I felt played a role at the time that he worked here in America, says Thomas Keller, who made regular pilgrimages to Jean-Louis at the Watergate to see what the genius chef was up to. He was super dynamic. Here was a guy who would change his menu every day. He'd have four different menus every day. So I look back on what I was doing, and he truly inspired what I was doing. There was repetition in the menu, but still, it was four different menus every day, four different prices. He would handwrite it. It was all about the product coming in. Where was the product coming from? That drove his menu. And they were changing it right up to the moment service started. It was extraordinarily presented in a refined atmosphere with great service, great wine. This was everything I wanted to do. And so for me, he was truly inspiring. You look around and I think a lot of people would point back to Jean-Louis as one of those first individuals who really changed the way we cook, the way we think about cooking in a holistic way. He was like a rock star, says Tracy Desjardins, who cooked for Payadon. He was like Mick Jagger. He was skinny, wiry, but so intense. I can remember him coming over and tasting stuff I was making, and looking at my station and talking to me and talking to Joaquim Splitchell about me. He was like this curious force, like this animal in the kitchen, and you could just tell he was taking in all of it. He was looking at every cook, and he always remembered what each person was about and what they did well. That guy made sauces, and she was the fish cook. He never forgot. He was a force. He really, to me, should be considered an American chef, says Jasper White. Jean-Louis was a magician. He was the chef of chefs in the U.S. Forget about the cerebral part of cooking. Let's just talk about skill. Jean-Louis, if he did a tasting menu for you, he could cook as long as you could stand it. He could just keep putting stuff out. But not only would he do a course, but if there were four of us at a table, and let's say the combination was shrimp and corn, he didn't do one dish with shrimp and corn and all four got it. He did four dishes, so you'd have a tasting menu where every course had four different dishes on it. It was freaking mind-boggling, but he could accomplish it. And I know it was a flow of creative genius because he didn't sit around and read books and stuff. He was out partying all the time, smoking and drinking. He was a lot of fun to be around. I think a lot of chefs would agree. Anyone who really knew him would say that he was the chef of chefs in America. It was too much, too fast for an ordinary human. I don't know how he did it, It was an endless flow of like every chef that ever lived funneled into this energy. He was brilliant. The book was also noteworthy for its geographic breadth, including chefs such as Amy Ferguson from Houston, Texas, Robert Rossellini from Seattle, Washington, and Richard Perry from St. Louis, Michigan. There were two people standing where I used to work. For all the focus on new American food, there were also productive years for American chefs operating in the French tradition. In 1985, Drew Naporant, a 1977 graduate of Cornell University's School of Hotel Administration, who had worked on cruise ships and at such New York hotspots as Maxwell's Plum and Tavern on the Green, opened Montrachet, installing chef David Boulay in the kitchen. Naporant had discovered Boulay across the country, at lunch at Sutter 500, the gig to which Verger had dispatched him from Le Cirque. Boulay cooked Naporant a tasting menu, which the restaurateur still recalls as one of the best he'd ever eaten. He raised the money to open Montrachet, named for a Burgundy wine-growing region, on the edge of Tribeca, which wasn't much more developed than it was when Odeon opened years earlier. He hadn't realized it in San Francisco, but as he saw the chef's food up close on a daily basis, he realized that Boulay was literally pinching like the lobster salad, or there was a Girardet dish. Basically, David took a dish from Trois Gros, Girardet, Verger. But I think in David's head he was elevating the dish because he's that skilled. So he didn't see it as taking the dish. Naporant dressed like a waiter on the service floor, wearing the standard-issue Montrachet uniform. Remembers Daniel Rothstein, who had previously worked with the Waltucks at Chanterelle and helped Naporant manage the front of house at Montrachet. We all dressed in a uniform. It was silly. It was all black with a silver tie. Drew dressed just like that, because he worked. He was a waiter. I mean, he was the maitre d', but he didn't want to distinguish himself. He liked that, and he also felt he could be sort of undercover, too, sometimes, so people didn't know him. He was on the floor. He would bring out dishes. He had no problems with that. He had no attitude. That guy was working. He was working the floor. He was dressed like everyone else. Before long, Naporant and Boulay were at odds, in part because Boulay, who brings an artistic temperament and manner to the kitchen, took his sweet time, keeping people waiting inordinate lengths of time for their courses, a bad time with Naporant's tendency to overbook. "I don't know if they were ever friendly," says Rothstein. "I certainly didn't feel that from Boulay. He just looked down on Drew. And Drew has a big ego. One of the things I was impressed by with Drew sucked up to the important people. He knew them by name, gave them the best table, all over them. But if you pushed him far enough, there were customers. If they pissed him off, I saw him throw people on the street twice. Drew overbooked. It was the hottest restaurant. He was going to take advantage of it. He was going to make money. So people were waiting at the bar for a long time. They'd made the reservation a month in advance or 2 months in advance. Sometimes people would get really angry. Someone got really angry at him and he just went off on him. He'd say, 'This is my restaurant. I'm the owner. You can't talk to me that way. I'm not serving you. Get out of here.' He was very ambitious," remembers Rothstein. "He would say, 'I'm going to be the next Joe Baum.' He knew everybody. I mean, just the way he remembered your name, I couldn't believe it. Some vice president of CBS would walk in the door. Maybe he'd met the guy, but he knew who it was. He must have studied the papers. He understood that with these important clientele and the rich, powerful people in New York, you know them by name and you greet them. He was amazing that way." Naporant also took no chances where critics were concerned. "The different owners would call each other and they would try to get descriptions," says Rothstein. "No one had a really good pick. If he thought there was a reviewer, he might call someone who had seen them to come over and take a look in the dining room. I think what Drew did, which Karen and David Waltuck wouldn't, if it was a reviewer, he would stop the kitchen. I mean, every restaurateur wants to make a perfect thing. But Karen and David would be sort of like, whatever. They wanted it to be good, but no one else was going to suffer for it. At Montrachet, other people would probably have to wait longer." Carrie Heffernan, who had cooked with Boulay at Le Perigord Park, returned from a stage in Europe circa February 1986 and joined his old chef in the kitchen at Montrachet.
I was Garde Meunier, says Heffernan. And Garde Meunier there? It sucked, because it was a tiny little space, and you had to make an eggplant terrine every day, which meant slicing and frying a case of baby eggplant, making a pesto, making a red pepper coulis, baking off a custard in a terrine mold, you know, the bottom of the terrine mold with two half moons of goat cheese into it. And then layering this eggplant, pepper, pesto, probably 15 layers. And then the pepper coulis had a little gelatin in it so it would hold together. Then you had to get it set, and then slice it, and then lay it on a plate, and then warm it, and serve it with a parsley sauce. It was still a wonderful dish. It was a beautiful dish. In those days, I wasn't quite aware of what was happening in the dining room. It was a bit of a mystery. We went in early. We busted our ass. We got out late. We drank Pabst Blue Ribbon. It was intense, but it was fun. There was a camaraderie. The restaurant earned 3 stars from the New York Times. But like more and more chefs in New York, Boulet had designs on opening his own restaurant and was making moves in his free time. The situation led to Napoorn making his own moves, worthy of Michael Corleone. Boulet was taking calls, says Rothstein. The phone was on the bar. He would be in the dining room. He was on the phone all the time at the end. And Drew was pretty sure he was talking to this investor, which turned out to be true. He would invite him. The guy would come in for dinner. So Drew started to feel like Boulet was just flaunting it, that he was going to leave. It was pretty bad. I mean, I understand Boulet, you know. Drew was extreme that way. But they just broke down. They just were not a good pair. And I think Drew felt Boulet was going to leave, and he wanted to be preemptive. That was pretty bold of Drew. I was impressed that he was confident enough to do that, with 3 stars on the line. And he kept those 3 stars. This is the thing, says Rothstein. He loved the restaurant, but he was a businessman. And he is a businessman. He knows how to make money in a restaurant, which is not an easy thing to do. Basically, that's the story of the conflict between him and David Boulet. David Boulet was an artist, and didn't care at all about money. And Drew watched every penny. With plans to fire Boulet, Napoorn began training a phantom crew, because he knew that the cooks would follow the chef out of loyalty.
I didn't understand how to do it, says Napoorn. So I basically trained an entire kitchen at a friend of mine's kitchen. I had a chef and 4 cooks. His name was Brian Whitmer. He had been sous chef to Bradley Ogden. I couldn't hire another chef to replace a chef. I had to hire a friend.
Recalls Heffernan. Memorial Day rolls around, and Drew says, you guys are going to get 2 days off. You're going to get Sunday off. You're going to get Monday, too. But take your knives and your shoes and all your stuff out of your lockers, because we're going to exterminate, and that stuff gets everywhere.
When Boulet showed up after the weekend, Napoorn had packed all of his belongings into a van.
Here are the keys to the van. All your stuff's in there, he said.
Boulet, says Napoorn, was incredulous.
So he comes down to the restaurant and he walks in. He sees that whole crew was cooking. And what was interesting is, I knew we'd make it because the next day, we always had 100-plus covers on the book. And one of my very best customers, I see they're walking towards the kitchen because a lot of people would walk into the kitchen if they knew David. And I stopped them.
Oh, we want to thank David. Tonight was the best meal we ever had here.
It was the first day of the new chef. I went, oh, it's his birthday. I gave him the day off, which I didn't realize it, but it had been his birthday the day prior. So we come back on the Tuesday, and the only person he had fired, to my knowledge, was David, remembers Heffernan. Everyone else was still employed, but there were 2 people standing where I used to work. And what he did with the next chef, says Rothstein, it was basically Drew. Brian Whitmer was the next guy. He was a nice guy. He was completely different. Drew was basically executive chef and was saying, this is what I want. They worked on the menu together. Brian would do it. Brian had his own ideas too, but Drew was very controlling. You know, he sort of wasn't going to let that happen. And amazingly, they were able to keep 3 stars there for a while.
A young Thomas Keller, who had worked at various Midtown French restaurants and at Le Rive in the Catskills, took his first stab at opening his own place in December 1986, partnering with Sergei Raoul, owner of the popular Soho bistro Raoul's. Raquel, the name was a mashup of Raoul and Keller, was a bit of a mutt, representing Keller's and Raoul's sensibilities. Keller, a dead-serious perfectionist, had a piano kitchen, insisted on absolute cleanliness at all times. Meanwhile, the artistic Raoul positioned a camera on Varick Street, featured a closed-circuit television in the dining room, projecting the traffic outside. He enlisted Tom Colicchio as sous chef. Heffernan, who would become friendly with Colicchio during a stage in Auch, used to meet up with him after service to talk about our crazy bosses.
We fucked it up.
The devastating Black Monday stock market crash of October 19, 1987, rippled through the industry. Some restaurants closed. Others reconsidered their formality and pricing. The party line is that the economy claimed the Waxman Master Empire, but Master was already feeling it slip through their fingers months earlier. Tensions among him, Jonathan, and Janie, exacerbated by Melvin and Janie separating, grew, and the three were quickly becoming overextended, including a jams in London.
"It was an accident waiting to happen," says Master. "I don't know what we were thinking."
By July 1987, just 3 years after Jams launched in New York City, the party was breaking up. Master told Coleman Andrews of the Los Angeles Times that
"all our restaurants have really been more in Jonathan's character than mine,"
and that he longed to open a restaurant in the vein of Washington Square Bar and Grill and Stars in San Francisco. Sagebrush Canyon, with a Western theme, was still going forward in Soho, with the Jams team as investors only, while a plan for an L.A. branch of Hewlett's was scuttled. By 1988, Bud's had been closed. Jams London was sold off. Waxman renamed Jams J.W.'s. Karen Rush, who waited tables at J.W.'s, remembers witnessing the decline of the restaurant.
"Orders start coming in COD. There's your first clue. You know, the wine isn't really being restocked. There's some shrinkage going on. And then the announcement that we'll be closing for a week or two to do some renovations."
About a week into the renovations, Waxman called Rush. "I have some good news and some bad news."
"What's the bad news?"
"We're closed."
"All right, Jonathan. What's the good news?"
"You don't have to work for me anymore."
"We fucked it up," says Master. "I mean, Jams London was ridiculous trying to do that. We had all these uniforms from Alexander Julian, the designer, that were shipped over. Jonathan wanted to have all those over there. And they were all the wrong size when they arrived. It was a clusterfuck."
"It happened quickly, and unraveled quickly," says Flay.
"Part of the problem was that Jonathan didn't have any backup. You need backup. I think Melvin was incredibly charismatic, a good frontman. But underneath being the frontman, you also need a foundation. Jonathan was by himself. It didn't seem that way, but he was by himself, and he had these three properties, and he was going to open others. All of a sudden, they're doing photo shoots with Jonathan in his fucking robe laying on a bed. There are some things you just don't do. You get caught up in it all, and all of a sudden you're at a photo shoot, and some photographer says, 'You know what would be a good idea?' You have to say no, because people don't forget that shit."
Says Master, still rueful after all these years, "It sort of was tragic, because what we had was, I think, so special. No one in New York had seen anything like it. It really, really was different. Everybody who was anybody was at Jams. It was incredible. It was an amazing high. But I think, honestly, that we forgot kind of who we were, where we were going, and what we were doing, and what we had. And I was not a good administrator. I would say that right off the bat. Jonathan's strength was he was a fantastic teacher. He wasn't in the kitchen much. He was always off eating somewhere else, or he was always off going to Paris. I mean, you've heard that, I'm sure, from everybody about Jonathan. And that was one of his biggest problems. He just didn't want to be there."
Raquel,
which downscaled after the crash, was also assumed to be a casualty of the economy. But Keller is quick to expand.
There's never one reason that anything fails. It's an accumulation of a lot of different things, some of them small, some of them big. The big thing, of course, was the downturn in the economy. That was huge. That affected a lot of people. But a lot of restaurants thrived in that period in New York City. So what was it about Raquel? Well, we didn't have a sound business structure there. Accounting was void. There was really no accounting, so who knew what we were spending or how much we were making or where we needed to cut, where we needed to add? I mean, I had no clue. The managers that we hired weren't sufficiently skilled in accounting. They were really good dining room managers. They knew some procedures. I was a good chef, but I wasn't a good businessman. I mean, I had a clear vision on what I wanted to do from a food point of view. Was I able to maintain food costs? Evidently not. Was I able to maintain labor costs? Evidently not. So was it the best location? Not really. You know, we thought it was a great location, but in actuality, I mean, Christ, you have the Holland Tunnel 3 blocks south and the traffic is just ridiculous. You can't get to the place at certain times of the day. So what we thought was great in proximity to Raoul's and Soho, it just didn't work. So a lot of different things. Poor design, poor name. Raquel? Is that a really good name? Most people thought of Raquel Welch. It had a lot of good things about it, but a lot of confusing things about it as well. Was it fine dining? Was it a bistro? Sergei, his popularity and success at Raoul's was evident. And the struggles at Raquel were evident. It's like, why can't we be more like Raoul's? So he's struggling with me. His partner, you know, has a clear vision on food, and he has a clear vision on the success. It was a struggle. Raquel was going to change, and Sergei, we came to an agreement that, you know what? In order for him to have an opportunity to make his money back, you know what I mean? He's running the whole thing, right? And Sergei is an extraordinary man who was an extraordinary supporter of me, and did an extraordinary thing for me and several things after that that I'll be forever thankful for. He wanted to change it. He needed to make the restaurant successful so that he could at least get his money back. And I appreciated that. He appreciated the fact that I wasn't the person that was going to make it successful. So we agreed to part ways and to modify the restaurant and bring it to casual and call it Cafe Raquel. Keller went on to consult for David Lederman at Chez Louis and for John Clancy's, a Greenwich Village fish house. Meanwhile, in the face of the recession, Charlie Palmer, the former linebacker, pushed forward, realizing his longtime dream of opening his own restaurant at precisely the wrong time. But what was the threat of failure to a kid from Smyrna, New York? Everybody's looking at me like, how stupid is this guy? He's opening a high-end restaurant in the worst economy in 25 years. And I'm like, what am I going to do? I'm in the middle of this thing. I didn't give a shit, honestly. I didn't care. I was 27. I had no debts. I had no family. I always knew how to live poor. He had considered following the action downtown, partnering with Steven Greenberg, publisher of Fame magazine, owner of the Roxy Roller Disco, and scene maker, who envisioned the restaurant and a space on Green Street in Soho. But Palmer had his heart set on opening what he imagined as an American Lutèce, and to me that meant I wanted a restaurant and a townhouse. I felt at the time, whether right or wrong, that to compete with the great restaurants in New York and be considered in that realm, I had to be between 59th and 72nd Streets, and I had to be between 5th and Lex. That was the criteria. And so he partnered with Steve Solis and Nicola Cozzoni, who had done well partnering with Tuscan Pino Luongo in Il Cantinori, and had recently opened their own Greek restaurant, Perialli, and were willing to meet another of his criteria, that he wanted to own the real estate along with them. Palmer brought along some key members of his crew from the River Cafe, including Jerry Hayden and Neil Murphy, put the guys to work on the space and also on the upper floors, creating rentable apartments. After the kitchen was installed, Palmer would walk out onto the street, invite random swells to come in and try the food he and his crew were developing. "We called them sheetrock dinners," says Palmer.
At the end of the day, we'd sweep all the crap in the corner, and we'd put a table down, and we'd cook. For Palmer, everything about the scenario typified the times. We didn't have anybody telling us this is the way it had to be. You weren't bound by tradition in any way. It was a no-brainer to be cooking and practicing what you do in an illegal situation and literally bringing people off the street saying, "Hey, you want to taste some food?" We did that every night. Total strangers. We were not dressed in chef's clothes, but we were just in work clothes. People look at you like you've got frickin' three heads. Like, what are you talking about? And then you explain to them, "We're opening a restaurant. We're just chefs. Tell us what you think about it." They'd be like, "Oh, yeah, okay." They'd be like total strangers sitting down like, "Hi, I'm Pam. I'm George," you know, kind of thing, and they would taste food. We always had some wine. We'd get every wine guy coming in there trying to sell me stuff, leave some bottles because we're going to cook tonight. Half of them were open already. Ariel opened in 1988 and earned 2 stars from the New York Times. Different American schools began to emerge in New York City, and with Waxman temporarily off the grid and Keller and Boulay associated more with France than America, Palmer and Portali were seen as being the very point of the cutting edge. "It got really vibrant," says Telepin, "and there was a lot being written about it. Restaurants got looser. Danny opened Union Square at the time. At Gotham, you could go eat. You're in a suit, and I'm in a pair of jeans and a t-shirt. We could eat there together. I guess it was somewhat radical to have a meal like Gotham or Jam's, where it was totally casual, but the food was really terrific and really well thought out. I think that moment made everybody more comfortable about eating out. So you were getting the sophisticated French cuisines. Even Alfred did Beurre Blanc at that time. All these guys went to work in France. Charlie worked in France. Alfred worked in France. All these guys went out there and they came back and brought their French techniques. And they, of course, were thinking about what was going on in California with Jeremiah. I mean, Alice, her whole thing was based upon France. Her whole cooking was based upon France using California ingredients. You would meet over the years certain people who worked for each guy, and the truth is, nothing against Charlie, because obviously Charlie has done very well for himself. But there's 2 kinds of cooks, right?" says Telepin. "There's the kind that love talking about getting crushed and, 'Oh, my station was in the weeds.' But they don't talk about food in terms of taste and layers and textures. That was the great thing about Alfred. You learned. When I came to Alfred's kitchen as a cook, Alfred's about flavor, flavor, flavor. And the guys that I worked with, that was it. It was about flavors. When Alfred would talk about a dish, it wasn't like, 'Throw it on the grill and let's fucking sear the shit out of it.' It was all about seasoning correctly. It was Jean-Jacques Rochot at Le Côte Basque. It was Daniel Boulou, and it was Alain Sayoc, and 3 or 4 chefs who historically trained everybody," says Jeffrey Zakarian, who worked around New York City during these years. "Then it became Charlie Palmer. Then it became Alfred Portali. Then it became that school. So the tree grew very rapidly." These 2 groups were summed up in a 1993 piece by Trish Hall in the New York Times, remembered to this day by the cooks who worked for Palmer and Portali. Though the piece focused on Gotham and the River Cafe, Hall's primary River Cafe reference point was Palmer. While there are exceptions to every generalization, 2 characteristics seem to stick, wrote Hall. "Gotham cooks all make tall food, and the River Cafe guys, and they are all guys, look like rugby players." I started to, with huge resistance, understand what he was about. Despite a seeming burnout, Waxman made a comeback. He returned to California to open the short-lived Table 29 in the Napa Valley, most notable because it put Waxman in place to pass through Yountville, notice that the French Laundry was for sale, and tip off Thomas Keller, who had migrated to Los Angeles and would go on to open there. Waxman returned to New York, opened a succession of restaurants, then settled in at Barbudo in the West Village in 2004. Today, he's attached to several restaurants around the country,
and has emerged as one of the industry's most beloved elder statesmen. In addition to his own Phoenix routine, Waxman grew in the estimation of many who worked for him, including several former kitchen skeptics. "The funny thing is, I have a lot more perspective now," says Tom Carlin, who today owns the Gladstone Tavern in New Jersey. "At the time, I thought he was a complete fake, phony, and he didn't really do anything. Of all the chefs I've worked with, my style is probably closest to his. So when he told me some things, it really stuck with me. I remember his philosophy well because I'm kind of doing it. I've been doing his half chicken since I was there. It's one of the best things that we do here." "It's funny," says Ed Fertig. "Doing things simply, having the great ingredients. I've carried that through me, no matter where I've been. Even right now, the company I'm with, we have 4 Irish pubs, but we make everything in-house. We're known as much for food as our 25 beers on tap. And on the special sheet, I'll kind of do whatever, and it usually works really well. When I was chef at a place in Aspen for years, I did a foie gras dish that was awesome, and it was really simple. Had I not had the jams experience, it probably would have been a lot more involved, and it didn't need to be. I think you need both. You need that tough French cooking training, and then you have something like Jonathan." "That was me in my 20s. My naivete and my overinflated ego," says Jerry Hayden. "I look back now and realize what Wolfgang was doing. He had done so much of that cooking, that French, European-style cooking, that he was sick of it. And he was expressing what Wolfgang wanted to cook. Now I get it. Wolfgang was creating his own style. And Jonathan, too, absolutely. He's a pioneer. If you asked me when I was 21 what I thought about jams, I would have told you it's an overpriced place where they serve chicken and shoestring fries, because I was young and stupid." Perhaps most jaw-dropping is Eric Bromberg's revelation. Not only did Waxman, who could have had a side career as a chef recruiter during these years, an American Mark Sarrazin, set him up with a job at the American Hotel in Sag Harbor, shocking his former employee, but Bromberg, who today presides over the Blue Ribbon Restaurant Group with his brother Bruce, also came to value his experience at Jams more than he might have imagined possible. "I started to, with huge resistance, understand what he was about," says Bromberg. "Taking all the French knowledge and removing the fluff and bullshit and just cooking well. And just, for instance, the restaurant I worked at in Paris and all the food I learned in cooking school. A pigeon, okay? Take the pigeon. The whole pigeon with the head on. Sear off the skin. Put in the mi-pois. Put it in the oven. Deglaze it with sherry or whatever we did, and then make a butter out of the drippings. Take the bird, present it to the guest, bring it back to the kitchen, cut it off the bone, lay it out, put the vegetables, do this whole composed thing. 6 people are involved in making this one dish, including the waiters. And at Jams, the squab was cut from the back and butterflied. Take the carcass, take all the center bones out, lay it out, cook skin side down on a grill, season, put it on a plate with a pile of shoestring fries and a little bit of, like, a port glaze. That was it. And it couldn't be more opposite. So it took me a while, I would say, to get over the resentment and the anger and the restructuring of what my brain thought of as food. At first, I was like, this guy's an asshole, and what a mess. And why not make this cool presentation of the pigeon? Why do it this way? But ultimately, in the long run, that experience had more of an impact on my style of cooking since then than anything. The simplicity of cooking each thing properly and separating out the ingredients, even if they go together on the same plate. You know, the leg and thigh don't cook the same time as the breast, so why not break it down first and do it separately and then put it back together? Why cook the vegetables for 25 minutes or whatever it may be, and do white wine and butter and this, that, and the next thing? Why not just blanch them for a minute and season them with sea salt and a little bit of olive oil or whatever? That kind of spirit of light and quick cooking struck me. And I'd never cooked on a grill to that extent. And keeping a fire on a wood grill going and consistent, so you can grill stuff all throughout a night when you have 6 hours of service and you have to load charcoal,
You're loading wood in while you're cooking and having enough cooking space to do it. That was a pretty intense learning curve. Had I not had that experience, I would be somewhere in the fancy food, high-end French world now. Experiencing that brought me back to America and brought me to understand what this movement really was and what the point of it was. And I'm not sure I really saw it while it was happening. It took me a while to really grasp it and understand.
7. She's not there. We did the dinner that they served on the Titanic. Andy Fortzheimer. How Jeremiah Tower poured his life into stars, creating the American brasserie, well, for better and worse, never letting go of the past. It was New Year's Eve, 1985, and in the Star's kitchen things drew to a standstill just before midnight. The final minutes of 1984, the restaurant's maiden year, were at hand, and the team, at the behest of their leader, stopped to savor them before they ticked away into the past. Jeremiah Tower popped open a Nebuchadnezzar of Dom Pérignon champagne, strode among the stoves and grill, pouring flutelets for his chefs and cooks from the 15-liter bottles which stood higher than the restaurant's tables. Stars was just 6 months old, but it sucked up most of the available oxygen in San Francisco's dining community. Fashioned after Paris's La Coupole, and credited with birthing the American Brasserie, Stars was an immense multi-level space with a piano player, an open kitchen and oyster station, its walls adorned with Art Nouveau posters and historic menus, its entrance set not on Polk Street, where there was a door, but in speakeasy style, on Redwood Alley alongside. If the story of the American restaurant chef to this point was the exploration of self and country through food, Stars amped things up with restaurant as autobiography. A seamless, delirious, ostentatious marriage of food and design, service and style, all of it exploding from one man's life and times. Over the course of its 15 years, in an industry bubbling over with larger-than-life figures, Tower emerged as the most operatic, scaling the greatest heights, taking the steepest falls, and, seemingly indestructible and indefatigable, capable of repeating the cycle ad infinitum. It was, and remains, quite a ride. He would sort of infuse ideas into us. The facts of Tower's life are such that he'd be compelling even if he'd never become a chef or accomplished anything of note. Born into a wealthy family, his father, an abusive man whom he detested, an international managing director of Western Electric, lived impossibly well on his family's oil fortune. Tower spent his childhood in far-flung locations around the world, London, Sydney, Hawaii, and on ships such as the Queen Elizabeth. He was, he claimed, first turned on to the wonders of food at age 6 in Australia's Great Barrier Reef by an Aborigine named Nick, who taught him to drink coconut water from the shell and roast barracuda. The man, in an episode Tower has only ever referred to with abstractions and metaphors, taught him about the birds and the bees, schooling the young boy in what to do with his lizard. Whatever happened on that beach, he would forever link food and sex. Food became a comfort to Tower, a source of pleasure and nurture, what he called in his memoir, California Dish, an escape into a private universe of glorious sensation. One of the many things that set him apart from his contemporaries was that he didn't have to discover the best food in the world as an adult. It had always been there for him, savored in the finest restaurants and at sea, as when, in 1950, his family took a trip around the world. Following Tower tradition, Jeremiah became a Harvard man, entering the university's School of Design. An Atlantis obsessive, he drew up plans for an underwater habitat project and a bridge tunnel passageway from England to France, but they were met with skepticism, the faculty directing him toward public housing. He famously created a presentation titled Champagne While the World Crumbles, a film loop of a mushroom cloud set to rock and roll and best appreciated with marijuana cookies, which he served. Tower hosted dinner parties in college, often extravagantly. He had become a collector and connoisseur of cookbooks and menus, and spent much of his leisure time deepening his connection to food, amassing enough information to rival his architectural education. In 1972, he moved to California, and early the next year, down to his last dollars and desperately in need of employment, had that fateful interview at Chez Panisse. In the late 1970s, with Chez Panisse behind him, Tower, though he had no formal training himself, began teaching at the California Culinary Academy. Among his students was Mark Franz, a young cook born in San Francisco in 1952, to a German father and Yugoslavian mother. Franz recalls a tasting class Tower conducted. "It was a tasting class of anything," says Franz. "Olive oil, vinegar. He taught us how to make vinaigrettes, that kind of stuff. It was my sophomore class, and there were 25 of us. It was fun because he really had no rules. It was more of, he said, okay, you've got oil, you've got vinegar, you've got salt, you've got pepper, you've got this, you've got that. And he would give you amounts, but he would say, they don't necessarily mean much because it depends on the salad you're making, depends on the green that you're dressing. There's a million variations. He empowered you. When you were done, you knew how to make the vinaigrette. And to this day, a lot of people are clueless. So you learn step by step by step by step. He just kind of gave you the big picture." Franz was dazzled by Tower. He brought passion. Oh, amazing. He was extremely articulate. And in those days, cooks weren't the sharpest pencil in the deck. So he brought arrogance. He was worldly. He traveled all over the world. The guy knew how to eat. He knew how to cook. He's a piece of work. Franz remembers his classmates as all older people reinventing themselves. A lot of them were bikers or ex-bikers. And they were ex-druggies and ex-this, and they were trying to rearrange their lives. When we first started off in my freshman quarter, there were 82 people. When I graduated, there were 15. They all just went by the wayside. At the time, Tower was also heading up the kitchen of the Balboa Cafe, owned by notorious restaurateur Doyle Moon. At night, Franz and Tower would hit Vanessi's on Broadway, in San Francisco's North Beach neighborhood, and do what Franz reverentially refers to as holding court. Inevitably, friends of Tower would come by, some flitting through town from Europe. They'd also put away unspeakable amounts of alcohol. "I learned how to drink from the man," says Franz, who considered Tower a genius, sensed that he was about to change the cooking game in America, and saw his meal ticket, becoming Tower's sous chef at the academy, running the production kitchen, fulfilling banquet obligations. Then, crucially, honed his technical skills working under chef Jackie Robert at Ernie's. Tower, again in conjunction with Doyle Moon, took over Santa Fe Bar and Grill after Mark Miller and Susie Nelson pushed off. The restaurant is remembered as a stopover, a paycheck, but the themes and approaches that would soon define Tower's career were in evidence. He assembled a group of cooks, headed by Franz, who was quickly solidifying his role as Little John to Tower's Robin Hood, and they would collaborate, brainstorm ideas over an after-service beer or champagne, Tower's favorite, in the restaurant or at a bar. Nothing was off the table, from braising goat with cactus to devising new ways of cooking Dover sole. He would sit at the table and we'd be drinking champagne and he would sort of infuse ideas into us, says Franz. Steve Vranian, who had quickly become one of Tower's most trusted chefs and lieutenants, describes the vibe at Santa Fe as an academy unto itself. During the day at Santa Fe Bar and Grill, it was more like a history class. We were trying to go back in time and recreate things. We were always researching recipes, so we had to go find old books and old magazines. And this was before the internet, before you could just Google something. I think part of it, for me at least, was just this huge interest in history. And it didn't matter what the culture was. A lot of us took that stuff home and came back the next day
Or if we did go out to eat, we would be picking it apart, not just the food. You would sit there and say, "Oh, their vents are dirty. What's up with these guys?"